Now back to Dr. John Alexander and Colonel Philip Corso in Las Vegas. Let's back up a little bit. You said you saw actual autopsy reports. How many details do you remember from that?
Oh, I remember quite a few.
What can you tell us? What was in those reports?
Number one, they had a third eyelid. And this eyelid was a collector of light, because these creatures could see at night. And we used that as a basis, one of the bases for our night viewing devices, imaging intensifiers, we call them.
In other words, what we now know as night vision goggles.
That's right. They came from that. That's the seed. And the German Ultra, they had experiments that they were doing on infrared. And the Germans, I had their documents, and I was very fortunate that I had the scientist there who could explain the documents to me.
Okay, here's where we need to back up a little bit. What knowledge did the Germans have, and how did they get it? Now, the crash that I know about was in New Mexico, but you keep referring to German scientists.
There was a crash in Germany, from Olbert's telling me what he told me, and there was also some crashes in Russia. And Wilbur Smith, the Canadian genius on electromagnetism, brought us a piece of metal that he got from a downed flying saucer in Canada.
All right. As I recall the last interview we had with you, when you were employed by General Trudeau, one day, or serving under him, I guess I ought to say, one day the general brought to you a filing cabinet.
This was right after he made me head of the Foreign Technology Division.
So it was almost your first job for him.
Well, it wasn't my only job, unfortunately. I had a lot of other duties.
Well, if you were in charge of research and development, John, what kind of work was he doing in R&D?
Well, what he was doing in foreign technology, and one of the things they did was we would recover technology from a number of places. We had called foreign material exploitation, and a lot of it, of course, was Soviet. And we would get a piece of advanced technology, we would bring it in and give it to the laboratories and say, reverse engineer it. How does it work? What are the operating parameters?
Figure out what this is. And
right,
how.
So that's a lot of what they were doing. He's, of course, carrying it to another level.
Now, the helicopter came from France, the Army and the helicopters. The spent uranium that they tried to talk about and said they wanted to outlaw after the Gulf War. Uranium, I got that from the Swiss.
Are you referring to depleted uranium
depleted uranium
shells? Yes.
I got that from the Swiss.
From the Swiss.
And then the South Americans had one of the best anti-aircraft units at the time. And then we got a 20-millimeter from the Germans. So we were taking foreign technology where it appeared in the world. And also, the foreign technology also uncovered other worlds.
All right, that's...
Remember the book is Project Horizon, very important. We were going to put a military colony on the moon in the early 60s.
We were going to put a military... In other words, there were plans
to
do that.
Project Horizon.
Uh-huh.
There's 50 pages are in the book, but the project itself was 310 pages. In fact, I had a hand in declassifying it.
John, Dr. Alexander, John, have you looked into this aspect of... the Colonel's story that we had a whole plan to put a base on the moon?
Oh, that absolutely exists. He's given me a copy. And one of the things that's not very well known is that, you referred to the Germans before. Remember, that was Operation Paperclip, where at the end of the war we had selected a number of scientists, Werner von Braun and
right.
Oberst and others, and brought
right.
them in. And they were working for the Army. And so the Army had developed this plan, and then when NASA was formed, the plans went over to NASA. So basically the plans and they were very detailed on how to get from here to there, and not just travel, but actually to establish bases and fight in space, was being thought about in the 50s.
All right, so this was sort of an ongoing, we've got to get there before they do kind of plan.
Well, we made the plan and wrote it up like it was aimed at the Russians. But if the plan is read and General Trudeau's instructions, they're in the book. But the letters he gave of instruction, You see that we were aiming at any enemy from outer space also. And MacArthur knew about this.
So obviously at that point they had hard knowledge that there were others and that they were not necessarily friendly at all.
Yes, and what we said, just in case, was our motto.
Just in case. Yeah, just in case. All right. John, where would you think it would be appropriate we take the story now?
Wow. Well, we have kind of gone all over. I think what Phil did from his perspective for research and development. Let me, maybe I'll add another note, if I might. I have had the opportunity to talk to a number of Phil's contemporaries, and the story is very interesting, and I've got to tell you, it's a paradox. I'm talking about people who went on to have ranks at 3- and 4-star general levels, who
yes.
were colonels at the time.
Right.
And I would ask them, you know, the big question is, where'd this stuff go? And I'd say, do you have it? Can you corroborate it? And they would say, no. And so I said, then we should not believe Phil Corso. And they said, oh, no, he did really strange stuff.
In other words, they're saying, I don't want to admit to any of this. I don't want any part of it. But then you ask about Colonel Corso, and they say, well, yes.
Yeah, they give him very high marks, and these were contemporaries. They were guys who were colonels with him, and as I said, they stayed in and progressed, and at least one of them took General Trudeau's position 2 or 3 moves down, you know, several years later.
All right, let's try developing as we did in the last interview, Colonel, because it is very important. Tell the story about General Trudeau one day delivering to you a file cabinet.
Yes. Well, he gave me the file cabinet, and he said, Phil, there's some things in there. I want you to develop a program for utilization and exploitation of these.
Utilization and exploitation.
With applied engineering. That means go out to industry and people are working on this. You find them, you develop a plan for me.
All right, here you had a file cabinet full of all this stuff. Where did he say it came from?
He didn't tell me. He said, it's in there, Phil. It'll tell you where it came from.
So normally you were working with Soviet stuff or German stuff or whatever.
Yes.
So I would think that at that moment you probably thought that's exactly what was in the cabinet.
Yeah, well, I had 3-drawer cabinet, Mosler safe. And the top drawer was, I used to... General Trudeau used to kid me and says, that's Corso's junk drawer.
Yeah.
And UFOs fly in and out of that drawer. And because when I'd lay these artifacts on the table, they look like junk. So he laughed about that and said, "My Corso's junk pile."
What was in your junk pile, Colonel?
Well, there was a piece of metal, about a piece of postcard, and the atoms were lined up and aligned in it.
The atoms were aligned.
Aligned. That made it give it terrific strength. Radiation wouldn't pass through. And he gave me the instruction. He told me one day, he said, Phil, I'm going to appoint a special team, and you're in charge, and the general that John just talked about knows about that team, because he was there at the time. He was a colonel with me. And that team, he told me this. He said, Phil, this is bigger than Los Alamos. Space vehicles, light as a feather, can travel space, no radiation penetrate it, and nothing can harm them. Because it was paper thin, but the strength was terrific. You couldn't dent it, we couldn't scratch it or anything. Of course, and he told me also, if you find anybody is even coming close to this, fund it. And I had the German scientist work with me on that.
So at that point, you took that and you tried to turn it over to somebody in industry and funded them because you had that power.
Yes, we did. I had the power to fund it.
And basically said, back engineer this or figure out what it is, figure out how to make it?
Well, Livermore Lab up at MIT analyzed it for us.
Well, they did.
Yeah, the atoms were lined up in it. I wrote them a letter. And I also wrote Walter Reed a letter. Walter Reed said... started some interesting discussion there. And my co-author has the letter. And then I wrote to Livermore, and I asked him, the question whether they could supply any. They said, do you remember the contract, how it read? That we would send all copies back to you and keep nothing here. And they were right.
A technical correction, by the way, that's a Lincoln Lab.
Oh, that's
MIT.
Lincoln. You're right, John. I'm glad you caught that. That was Lincoln Lab. Livermore's on California. So they did that, and they remind me that we made them send all copies back to us to keep nothing in their file.
Uh-huh.
And we funded after all, so they did that. Then I had a... Now, this is an interesting story, Art. I had a piece of looked like string.
String.
The atoms were aligned in it. It was so tough you couldn't burn it, and you couldn't even cut it.
Was it metallic, or was it light string
like
or cord?
Thread.
Like
it was
thread?
Like cloth. It looked like it.
All right.
The nearest thing in this world that we found that was nearest that was a spider web. Terrific strength. You can stretch a spider web for miles. The spider spins it and aligns the atoms in it. And you can stretch it 5-10 miles before it bends and won't break. And then it springs back into space. Now, we funded that with Wyoming University. We made flak jackets out of it. Only we couldn't make flak jackets because we couldn't get enough of it. We tried to get them to clone the spider, and I think to this day they haven't succeeded.
Huh.
But there's terrific strength in that, in the spider web. Marvelous thing. Atoms are aligned.
Atoms are aligned. Dr. Alexander, now with two pieces of material from this file cabinet that ultimately, I guess, came from Roswell, atoms are aligned. Can you explain that?
Not very easily, actually. As I understand what he's talking about is that instead of having a random selection of the atoms, that they were able to establish the polarity in such a way that the strength was greatly increased.
You're right, John.
But they were actually not able to duplicate the metal. Is that correct?
Well, we failed in that, Art.
Failed.
We were never able to do it.
All right.
Now, we invented a small atomic engine that's in the Saturn probes and the Mars probes.
Yes.
It was our little iron engine that we built at Fort Belvoir. And we could never harden that, so we couldn't put it in anything that man could travel in it, because we couldn't harden it meant keep the radiation out.
Let me read you this fax I've got, Colonel, and let me ask you about it. We have yet to develop how you got to this technology, but here's somebody reading your book, Colonel, and he says, I'm only halfway through the Colonel's book, but I've reached a very disturbing chapter. The Colonel says that the military has been fighting a war with the aliens since 1947 and considers the aliens to be enemies of the United States. Would you please ask the Colonel if it's true, and if indeed these aliens are our enemy?
Art, I had a list of overt acts on their part. Maybe accidental, maybe not planned, but they were overt acts. They killed our men, they brought down aircraft, and they even experimented on civilians. So we had to consider in the military that those were hostile acts. They were hostile.
Colonel, can you give me any details? You say hostile acts, overt acts. They killed our men, you said, and experimented on civilians.
Von Braun even wrote of a missile that was thrown off track by them, by electromagnetism. And we were at Ramstein Air Force Base. They shot at them. And that's in the book also. And the Maelstrom Air Force Base, they flew over that and they knocked out all our guidance system on our Minutemen missiles. The guidance system on every one was knocked out. And then at Bokonur, at the Cosmodrome in the Soviet Union,
yes, sir.
A UFO came over for 14 seconds and all their steel towers fell apart. All the welds and the rivets came apart. The Cosmodrome was down for about 3 weeks. And the UFO only was over 14 seconds. And also we had information that they followed all our Gemini and all the Russian Voskhod, I think, shot in the air. So we had all that evidence.
Okay. Art?
Yes.
One thing I might add, and this is, I'll be the cautionary note here, is when Phil here talks about the military, and that's a pretty inclusive term, because I don't think that most, if you went to the military, that you would get consensus on this. So this is clearly speaking for some people within the military, as opposed to an institutional position.
Yeah, I think John's right there.
All right. Well, clearly the acts were or appeared to be overt, but from what you have told me, short of people who may have died, it seems hard to conclude that their action was that of an enemy that wanted to come at us or have a war with us, because surely they had the technology to wage a much larger scale war than...
Well, Art, on that, we used to discuss, if they fight a war against us, are they going to fight on our level or their level? Now, that's a question we never quite answered. We didn't think that they were going to fight a war with guns and missiles like we do.
Uh-huh.
They were DNA experts. They made these clones of that superintelligence. And when I analyzed that clone, what a marvelous thing that was. We were remiss on that. We should have diagnosed that thing very minute. That was one of the greatest things they left us. And we were sort of remiss. We didn't do enough.
How much?
That was a marvelous thing.
How much actually did we do? I mean, you said you saw an autopsy report.
Well, we studied the digestive system. There wasn't any.
None.
There was no vocal cords.
No vocal cords.
No ears. They didn't. No sound. We figured that they had four lobes in the brain, and we figured that their communication was mental telepathy.
Would you call them biological entities?
We did. We made that name up. Extraterrestrial biological entities.
You made that name up.
We made that up in the Army, and we called them. We came to the conclusion that they were definitely clones made specifically for space travel, since man today cannot travel in space. Now, NASA might object to my book because I make that statement, that man cannot travel in space, yet these clones were made on that. Of course, somebody's going to come back and say, we spend billions and still man can travel in space. Well, it's a fact, and nothing I can do about it. It's true. And on Mir, when they come off of Mir, they've been up for 3 months. They have to help them off. The bone marrow and the muscles are affected.
All of that is true.
And the brain is affected, too.
As a matter of fact, there are some very interesting developments with regard to Mir and other space flights in which the crews have begun to get out of control. And I think we are not hearing all about Mir right now. This crew is not in control. They've been basically told, stop what you're doing, just rest. We're going to get you out of there. Back now to my two guests, Dr. John Alexander and retired Colonel Philip Corso. Gentlemen, you're back on the air again. All right, but then some other materials from that filing cabinet, for example, this fiber that you're talking about,
yes,
actually turned out to be what we now know as fiber optics. Is that right?
I had fiber optics. I had a bunch of... It looked like wires. I really didn't know what it was. And
right.
Light was emitted from them. There must have been a power source in it. And then we sent that, I think, to Monmouth that went. And from that, that was a development of fiber optics. But in those days, we didn't even know what it was, Art.
So you just sent it over and said, figure it out?
Yes, we gave it to our labs. That was our labs.
And once again, they weren't doing this gratis or for an investigation. You were commissioning them. You had budget money.
Exactly.
Research and development money that came along with these items
exactly.
You were giving them.
We had a budget then which was tremendous. It was about $2
billion. $2
billion. Now, we also gave out RDT&D contracts, research, development, test, and evaluation contracts. The first item that would be built from a research contract, we funded the building to the first one. Then after that, other people, other agencies funded it. So we would fund these until it was actually developed. And we had our own laboratories, our atomic labs, and the night viewing labs were our labs at Fort Belvoir.
So what,
still in existence.
Colonel, what aspect of this were you overseeing? In other words, once you gave somebody a piece of this technology and a budget, what did you then do?
Well, I was supposed to keep track of it, of how it was coming along. For example, I went down to the night viewing device lab one day, and I had their budget in my pocket. And the general told me, go down, see how they're getting along. And I took one of the German scientists with me and two Army engineers. We looked it over, and the commander there told me he had misgivings when he heard I was coming. I told him, is my reputation that bad? And then I told him, but in this case, it's a little different. Look at my German friend. He's smiling. He usually doesn't smile. And not only that, but since you're doing such a good job, here's your budget. And I handed him the envelope I had in my pocket. And I told him, but there's a hitch to that. The war is heating up in Vietnam. We need this viewing device for the troops with 3 to 6 months. They did it. And John knows he had one of the weapons or one of the rangefinders.
Well, as a matter of fact, Dr. John Alexander has been, would it be fair to say, Doctor, a developer of non-lethal technologies for years?
That's correct.
Doctor, can you, in essence, back up any aspect of this regarding night vision? In other words, was this, can you see a linear development anywhere with regard to night vision, or was it a sudden jump that would tend to back up what Colonel Corso is suggesting?
It's hard to say. And I've got to say, when Phil and I first talked about this and how they went about it, he described a classic black program in which it folds back in on itself, is almost untraceable. Because remember what he said, and this is in Phil's words, they found people who were already working the field.
Sure.
So that it would not show up as, here's something, you know, totally out of the blue.
So it could look as though it were some sort of natural progression.
Right. Yeah, the ultimate problem with, you know, if Phil is right, it means that we have to rewrite science. And you're going to, I mean...
We also have to rewrite history.
Well, I'm talking about the history of science, because it means that, you know, everything up to Nobel Prizes and people who have been awarded money and patents and all of that
should not have
got some help.
Now, we encouraged industry to take the patents, and I have supported this in a pamphlet written in 1963 by General Britton. We encouraged them to take the patents as long as they developed it.
Well, the alternative to that would be to tell everybody where it came from, so
right.
There was no choice.
Well, we couldn't do that because the climate opinion, they had destroyed our organization, Art.
I'm certain they would have. At some point, you must have sat down with General Trudeau, and obviously after you realized what you had on your hands in this cabinet, all of this technology, and you must have had a serious conversation with the general about where it came from, or did you never do that?
Oh, we did, almost every day.
Oh.
Now, let me tell you another thing, Art, you got to remember, too, how some of the developments came from the back door. In intelligence, you check also not actually what has happened, but you check omissions.
Right.
I walked in the general one day, and I told him, General, I got something here that's very serious. Now, I got to let you know, and we got to decide what to do. I told him, number one, there's no food aboard this flying saucer. No refrigeration facilities. There's no water. There's no toilet facilities. There's no recreation facilities.
Colonel, I've got to stop you and back up a little bit. You just said something quite remarkable. On this flying saucer, does that imply that you had a craft?
Well, not that we had in the Army, but I had the reports on the craft.
You had the reports?
Yes.
All right. Did these reports come to you along with the filing cabinet full of all these...
They did. They were in the top drawer of the filing cabinet.
So you had a full report on the craft they had recovered.
Yes. Well, as full as it could be in those days from what they saw.
I understand. Here you had the autopsy reports on the beings, extraterrestrial biological entities, robots virtually.
Yeah,
or
the Sumerians called them Igigis. I-G-I-G-I-S.
And then you had a report on the craft itself. Now, you said there were no facilities, and what you've told me of the extraterrestrial biological entities, it makes sense. They wouldn't need all that, would they?
No, they wouldn't. And also, when a general asked me, what do you think is, how do they survive? Well, I had Tesla's reports. And Tesla, you know, he was the genius in New York, and then went out to New Mexico. He actually set up his generator right up there in, at Colorado Springs.
Yes, sir.
And Tesla, in one of his writings, he had that the body itself is an electrical entity, our bodies. The cells are electrical. And you can propagate our system by electromagnetism. And Tesla actually said this. And I told the general, maybe this is a key, general, that they propagate themselves by electromagnetism. Because we knew that their guidance system was electromagnetic because of the way it affected some of our missiles and other items.
Right.
So for most emissions, we started what we called irradiated foods.
I'll be damned.
I told him this. We flew down the Quartermaster, or that was in Richmond, Virginia, and they fed us a steak that had been on the shelf for 2 years, no refrigeration. And we made, now, irradiated food today, it kills salmonella in chicken, it kills trichina in pork. Yeah, we won't put on the market because of do-gooders, and it's harmless. And the American Science Agency in New York has stated that it's harmless. Yet the do-gooders won't put it out because it says radiation.
So that's another technology that came from them.
It came through the back door, let's say, because it wasn't there.
And I've got a fax here that says, "Hi, Art. This is really not complicated. Colonel Philip Corso is simply telling the truth. The problem is there are going to be a lot of people that simply can't handle the truth, and they're going to be using a variety of psychological mechanisms, including suppression, denial, rationalization, to avoid dealing with this simple truth. And the truth is that, Colonel, you had all of this material given to you by General Trudeau, which you then apparently funded. In other words, you actually began to go to American industry and give them this material, along with budgets, to develop this technology. And what you're telling us is that the technology we enjoy today, much of it, fiber optics, night vision goggles, and on and on and on, all came from an alien crash or alien crashes. Do you know totally how many there were, Colonel?
No, I really don't have the count. I had about a dozen important items. So I don't know really at the moment. I'd have to go through my notes the book was taken from and see how many we did have.
Do you know, Colonel, whether you were the only one given these alien artifacts or whether others were doing parallel work?
I heard rumors that the Air Force was doing parallel work.
Uh-huh.
But we never cross-fertilized because we kept it to ourselves to protect our, let's say, our organization.
You also believe, do you not, that the Germans were doing some parallel?
They were doing it. Their scientists actually told me this, and people the caliber of von Braun and Obert.
All right. Yes. You've mentioned the names of several people, Colonel, who were involved over the years. Frank Kaufman, one of the still living firsthand witnesses.
I met him at Roswell.
I had him as a guest on this program a couple of weeks ago and claimed to have been part of the cleanup team at Roswell. Can you confirm that Frank Kaufman was involved in the cleanup?
Yes, I met him out there. I think he was a sergeant then. And he was very happy that I finally came forward. We had dinner one night at the Roswell Inn there, in Roswell. So I was introduced to him. It's the first time I met the man. And it seems he's my age, I think. And he was very logical and very emphatic of what he saw.
All right, well, one of the things he did, Colonel, was dispute your claim that a creature was shot at the crash site.
No, I'm not sure of that, whether it was shot or not. That I'm not certain of.
So that could be...
I think Kaufman is right on that.
All right.
I think I was sort of an error in there. I shouldn't have been in.
All right, since you've written your book, This is a very, very important book. If you believe it, it changes all of our history, or a great portion of our history, and what we think of ourselves. Has anybody senior in government come to you since the publication of this book and told you to shut your mouth?
No. No one.
Why do you think that?
When Mitchell the astronaut confirmed it, he confirmed that I was a sort of a maverick. And I don't take things of trying to stop me from talking lightly if anybody would try it. Nobody's ever tried it.
And again, the things that you're able to talk about, you're able to talk about because they really weren't classified in the normal way.
Well, Art, you can see that. The chip, for example, or the integrated circuit.
Yes.
It's now known worldwide.
Yes.
There's no classification. The supertenacity fibers, they're known worldwide now. There's no classification anymore. Mm-hmm. Fiber optics has developed tremendously since our day. Our communication, there's no classification anymore. The imaging devices, we made the first heart pump.
The first heart pump?
We made that. The Army did.
And that came from this technology
Yes. Florida Hydrodynamic. We had a car at Harry Diamond Laboratory, a little cart that ran on water. Same as integrated circuits, the electricity we put water through and it ran. And I told Senator Glenn about this, and he wanted a photograph that I had. I gave it to him, and I told him, call Harry Diamond Lab. They still might have it up there. It's the north of Philadelphia, north of Washington, D.C.
Do you retain a photograph of this?
Yeah, I have one.
You have one?
I gave it to Senator Glenn, the one I had, but I have another one.
And what did Senator Glenn do with it?
I don't know. I haven't talked to him since I gave it to him.
Well, Dr. Alexander, I can only imagine now with the book having been out for a while, with the claims the Colonel is making, after all, we're talking about some very serious technologies here, that there would be people coming forward and saying, this Colonel is out of his mind. We developed so-and-so in our lab, and we didn't get any special materials in order to do that. And I've heard none of that. Have you, John?
Oh, you hear some. Certainly. And you've got to remember, the way they did it, it makes it untraceable by design. So, I mean, if you remember, what Phil said was that they, if you believe the story, that they were handing it to people already working in the field, getting material that in some cases they thought was Soviet, but that the technology was beginning to move already.
Bell Laboratory confirmed that. They thought we got it from the Russians.
Well, at that time, and I'm just saying what I believe, our technological advances were far ahead of the Soviets, were they not?
Yes,
in most areas.
Some they weren't.
Yeah, that was not across the board. I mean, there were areas that the Soviets had done some work that exceeded our capabilities.
In fact, Art, we were really, one day, I went to the general, I was the first project officer on anti-missile, and I recommended the colonel, a friend of mine. He came to me one day and he said, I feel like I got something very serious. The Soviets can take their ICBMs and change trajectory in the air. That was a very serious thing. That left us almost without any defenses.
In other words, it is not a ballistic missile in the sense that you fire it and it has a specific trajectory and it goes up and comes right back down.
It was an ICBM.
So they
intercontinental.
And they acquired this ability before we did?
Yes, the capability of changing trajectory in space. In fact, we went to General Trudeau, and he got alarmed, too, because that was a very serious thing. And we went to work on, and we developed a countermeasure within a short time. It had a crash program.
All right. You said the reason you came forward is that General Trudeau said that you could speak after his death. But wouldn't all work at the Foreign Technology Division be covered under the security requirements, other security requirements that you had to sign? In other words, how were you released, not just from his personal oath, but from those other requirements?
The requirements, mostly in security, were on weapons and things we developed. And some of the laser developments are still classified. I didn't talk about those.
So there are things still
I had all the clearances, And from this book, I did not violate any security because we didn't have the stamp on one of these things. The normal R&D contracts we put out, most of them didn't have the stamps on. A Project Horizon was secret, and then it was declassified under the general's authority. And I did that, too.
And the general told you near his death that you could come forward after he died.
He said that.
Why do you think he didn't? Why do you think he wouldn't do it while he was still alive?
Well,
and back your story up.
Well, one day, I was discussing with the general some of these items.
Yes.
And I told him this, General, we have this integrated circuit. What are we unleashing on the world?
Right.
We don't know what this thing will do.
Right.
What if someday, and I pointed my head, it integrates with a brain? Are we going to create some monsters? And he said, Phil, yes, what you're saying is true. But let's hope that the people come after us will recognize this and do something about it. And then he stated this. He said, but maybe not in our lifetime. Well, it didn't happen in his lifetime. And even in 82, I happen to still be here.
Why, again, though, do you think the general didn't want any of this coming out when he was alive?
Because the climate of opinion and what was going on, even till he died 3 years ago, and even today, that anybody deals with this is a kook. In fact, I told the Germans one day, I explained something to them.
So he was worried about ridicule?
Yes. And also, the skeptics and the department, the people at ARPA and other places didn't like us. And we knew who our opposition was, and CIA didn't like us.
Uh-huh.
And there had been a lot of opposition, a lot of smearing, and a lot of good people might have been hurt.